Hey folks, welcome to today's Talkie Bit. This is a re-recording of what was done live in the context of community on September 25th, 2020. Re-recorded because of some technical issues with the original. The original, as one might suspect, given that it was live, is a little more extemporaneous than this. And so if you want to hear that version with all the, you know, all the glitches that go with something being live, you can find that on the table's Facebook page. Found myself doing two things this week that I don't think I've ever done before. And I'm headed somewhere with all of this. That's about an idea, of course. But if you wish, you could choose to take it as a kind of illustration of life not ending at the age of 40. I'm reasonably well past 40. And this past week, I did two new things. So there you go. The first thing was that I read through the entire book of Genesis out loud. All right, that's kind of an unusual thing to do. And in this case, it says nothing in particular about my own thoughts about the book I was reading from. It's not a commentary on my own takes on religion or spirituality or spiritual practices or disciplines or devotional life or anything like that. I did it for my daughter, Taya, who, because she's studying at a Christian liberal arts institution, is required to take some courses in theology. And Taya is somebody who takes in written material best by hearing it. So I was like, you need to go through the book of Genesis? I can read that to you. So we sat down together yesterday evening, and I read the whole thing to her out loud. She made a puzzle while she was listening. It was a perfect combination for her. Her mind was busy. Her hands were busy. Everything kind of settled to a place where she could take in the material and remember it. It worked great. I would say that reading through something like that out loud to somebody else in one sitting or two sittings, that's an interesting way to encounter that collection. It's very different than dipping into it here and there and saying, look at this text or look at that verse or here's the idea in a snapshot. It's really different to kind of have that whole experience. So it feels like it's humanized it in some ways. I came away with a couple of strong impressions. The first was that there is some pretty compelling storytelling in that collection. Very weird in many instances, but still powerful in its themes and shapes. I mean, I think there are reasons why there are still people in the 21st century West who find those stories of how the world came to be, how an entire nation came to be, so gripping that they insist against all evidence and reason that those might be literal Western-style histories. I can't get there myself. From my vantage point, choosing to read those texts that way both guts them of their best possibilities and also makes them vulnerable to being absolutized in ways that I think have done and continue to do a lot of harm. Generally speaking, it's not a good idea to take poems literally. Never mind ancient poems compiled by people whose perspective we can't ever really share and transmitted so far and so long it's impossible to know what their beginning shapes even were. I did feel a little more comfort engaging in all of this with Taya, knowing that her prof in this course had already talked to them about the telephone game and how, you know, you start with saying something to one person, they say it to the next person, and the next person, by the time it gets to person four, it's not even the same sentence. By the time it gets to person 20, it's not even the same idea. Some of these stories have traveled a long ways. It's worth keeping in mind. The second impression was that the big human questions really haven't changed that much over time. I think as a species, we still want to know where we came from. We want to have some sense of what our trajectory is. We want to have a narrative for what troubles us about the world, for how it might be that there could be such a staggering range of human choices and activities, all the way from life and beauty of such complexity and depth that sometimes when we encounter it deeply, it feels like it's gesturing toward perfection or utopia, paradise, to the most direct and horrible sorts of violence in which we do one another in and then try to hide the evidence, and lots of stories of self-interest kind of sandwiched in the middle. By the way, I just basically described a bunch of the big stories in Genesis right there. The other thing that I came away with from that experience was this impression that as humans, we don't seem to learn from our mistakes very well. If you want to explore that one from the Genesis narratives particularly, you could read the stories about how Abram and then his son Isaac both seem to think it's a good idea to try to convince powerful people that their beautiful wives are in fact their beautiful sisters, because the men in these stories are afraid for their own safety more than they're concerned about the well-being of their partners. And that's just a surface sampler. There are stories a lot stranger and more problematic than that in the book of Genesis. In lots of ways, reading Genesis wasn't all that different from reading any other speculative fiction or mythology. It required, on my part, considerable suspension of disbelief and the vigorous use of curiosity and imagination to consider what these stories might have to say to me in the here and now. And just to be clear, since some of us have grown up steeped in assumptions about what the Bible is and why one might read it that I don't personally have, I'm not suggesting everyone should do this. And I'm not suggesting that everyone who might choose to do this should understand it from a particular vantage point or in a particular way. It's just that this week I did it, and it did have something to do with exploring what I believe and the topic we're exploring in terms of belief this week, and so I wanted to share that with you. The second thing that I did this week that I've never done before is read something from the Scottish Journal of Theology. Did you even know there was such a thing? Some of you perhaps did. I did not, and I've spent good money and time studying theology. As it turns out, there's not only such a journal, but not surprisingly, I suppose, a considerable history of some pretty heavyweight theologians coming from that corner of Europe. You might, if you care to do so, reasonably wonder how I ended up there. I was looking for some thoughts other than my own about a different strange piece of ancient poetry found in the library we most often call the Old Testament, at least in the tradition I grew up in, and in this case found in the middle of a collection of incredibly enigmatic poems in the middle of the book of Isaiah. And the risk of getting into, you know, an angel's lane, have no fear. I am not about to launch into some kind of exposition about how Isaiah is really writing about Jesus. That's an idea that I find requires pretty much magical thinking to defend, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the nuances of what I read in that journal, although I was seriously tempted to read a short bit of it to us when we were gathered, just so we could all shake our heads at the incomprehensible language of the formal study of theology. I was reading a preface to one of the articles in the journal, and I was reading it, and I was thinking, I don't even know what those words mean. I used to study this. The language was really quite particular and exclusive, which I don't think is unique to the study of theology. I think there's lots of academic disciplines that are in that terrain. But I was backed up a little bit by encountering it again after a long time away. But I was in there because in this collection of poems that are often called the servant poems or names like that, there's a phrase that I find quite informative when it comes to imagining how we might pursue happiness in a world where there's often a shortage of it and in which there are so many reasons to doubt the merit or possible effectiveness of such a pursuit. Sort of like with my experience in reading Genesis, I was intrigued to find that the themes addressed and the questions raised are about as human as they get, and that one reason some of these texts might still be around is because they're not done talking to us yet. They might still have something to say. By which I do not mean they do have something to say to everyone and we should pay attention. I mean to say they might have something to say, and the only way to know that is to pay some attention. Different thing. These poems in Isaiah are kind of vaguely focused on a character called the servant of the Lord. Now, if you grew up around traditional Christian teachings, especially those informed by more theologically conservative or evangelical points of view, the working assumption was most often that this was some kind of prophetic reference to Jesus. A case of the writer of the poem saying, you know, more than they knew long before history had any character in it called Jesus of Nazareth. That way of thinking is a pretty easy fit, really, if you find yourself able to believe the underlying assumptions about the nature of God revealing God's self to humanity that are running in the background. And of course, in the background of that is just a huge set of assumptions about the nature of the mystery we use God language for. So there's a lot that you have to take as a given for that to work. Among other discoveries, I found out that I've got a lot of company in the highbrow world of formal theological studies when it comes to finding the idea that Isaiah was writing about someone that didn't exist yet not all that defensible. Which, if you start with skepticism about that more traditional perspective, then reopens the question, if not that interpretation of the servant of the Lord, then who might this servant of the Lord be? I'm going to try to save us all a bunch of time here. I'm going to say that for our exploration today, the poet is trying to do what we humans are continually trying to do, which is find a story that explains reality as he is experiencing it. We've talked about this before in this space, the idea that a phrase like thus saith the Lord in ancient biblical texts can often be read as thus saith reality, which is sort of another way of saying a writer is offering us their best shot at the nature of what is beyond them and not available for them to change. It's for sure not the only way to come at something like this, but it's the one I'm going to use today. And as always, my hope is that the particulars of what I'll share will be fuel for your own explorations. So here's the phrase from the poems that got me going on all of this in our context today. The poet is describing this servant of the Lord / servant of reality, and he describes that person as someone that is acquainted with grief. That's the phrase that caught my attention, acquainted with grief. If you want a fuller picture of this person, as the poet talks about them, you can find it in Isaiah chapter 53, where the poet goes well out of their way to make sure we understand a few things about this servant of reality, somebody who serves life as it is. They are, the poet tells us, about as ordinary as could be. There's no particular beauty or majesty about them. They're not a noteworthy person for the sorts of things that tend to gain public notoriety or attention. They are someone that came from hard circumstances, but they pushed through that to be present in the moment. They are not someone with a lot of friends or community. They're somebody that knows what it's like to be alone, to be without friends. In other words, I would say they're an ordinary person. And this ordinary person, this person acquainted with grief, or in many translations, familiar with suffering, is also the person that can see reality for what it really is, how it's a complex blend of sadness and joy, of struggle and relief, of weakness and strength. Their ordinariness is not a barrier when it comes to seeing into the deeper things, when it comes to seeing into matters of mystery and of spirit. The gateway, the portal, if you want, to that sort of seeing through, suggests the poet, is in part a willingness to be acquainted with grief. Acquainted is a relational word, right? To be acquainted with someone is to know them. To be acquainted with grief is to know it, to have sat with it, to have been in conversation with it. Now, I can think of all kinds of reasons why I don't like that idea, and why you might not either. The first one that comes to mind is that I don't like grief itself much at all. Grief is, in my experience, generally not a pleasant emotion. It's unpredictable. It's disruptive. It makes me cry in ways that are inopportune and sometimes quite messy. So it's not only difficult, but it's also hard on my ego. And, you know, if I wore makeup, it would probably be hard on that too. And it's distracting. It pulls me away from the things that my surrounding culture is constantly telling me I need in order to be successful. You know, things like focus and productivity. And it seems like it's pretty much the opposite of joy. So what's it doing here in the middle of exploring the pursuit of happiness anyway? I read someone this past week who suggested that many of us have a relationship with grief that is like the relationship between the characters of Edward Rochester and Bertha Antoinetta Mason in the novel Jane Eyre. And there is a spoiler coming up, just in case you haven't read the novel or seen a movie version and think you might want to. One of my literary friends pointed out that after 175 years, the statute of limitations on spoilers for Jane Eyre has probably expired, and I should just proceed without concern. But if you find yourself in the category of, I don't want to know this, you know, plug your ears and go blah, blah, blah for just a moment here while I read this. Because Bertha Antoinetta Mason is the violent and unstable wife that Edward Rochester hides in his attic. And you don't sort of find that out right away. And by the time you find it out, you have to read a bunch of the novel kind of backwards and re-understand it. So that's hence the spoiler. Anyway, here's something that I read that described Bertha as a metaphor for the way that many of us relate to grief. And I thought I could sum this up, but I like the way the person wrote about it. I'm just going to read you a bit of their description. I think most of us have a relationship with grief more like that of Edward Rochester to Bertha Antoinetta Mason in Jane Eyre. She's always there, but no one really knows about her. And for the most part, life goes on as normal. Sometimes a particularly sensitive person will hear her rattling around upstairs, but if they ask about her, we change the subject, suspiciously deny their inquiries, or, if we're really in bad shape, demand that they leave our house immediately and go live with missionaries. If that seems, you know, weirdly particular, it's a reference to something that actually happens in the novel, as are the following illustrations. But sometimes grief makes a fuss, banging around upstairs, moaning and shrieking, maybe even lighting the curtains on fire. She's pitiful, and we sort of resent her. She's keeping us from living a good life, marrying our sassy governess. We wish she would go away, but we feel a strange loyalty to her, like she needs care. If we leave her up there long enough, she'll eventually blind us and burn the whole house down. Again, if that seems strangely specific, it's a reference to something particular in the novel. Short version. For lots of us, grief is more like an unwanted house guest than an acquaintance. She lives with us, but we don't speak with her. And as a by the way, if you don't think grief lives with you because you can't think of any particular thing that you're grieving at the moment, I would suggest that anyone who's just lived through the last 2+ years of a global pandemic has grief in their attic or in their life. There's real loss when there's change on that magnitude. Things to grieve, for sure. If there's some merit to that suggestion, that grief lives with all of us, but we don't necessarily speak with her or make her acquaintance, perhaps a reasonable question is, why not? For the balance of our time today, I'm going to consider some of the why nots when it comes to choosing to make our acquaintance with grief, and then next week we'll consider what might be some good reasons for wading into that task anyway. So we're going to leave this very much as unfinished business today. As always, I'm speculating here, but I also suspect some of this will touch on themes that are common enough to be resonant for many of us. So, why might we not feel able or willing to make the acquaintance of grief or her close relatives' fear and anger? One reason for lots of us is because we grew up in families where some emotions were only experienced in damaging ways. A classic example might be that we experienced anger primarily as an emotion expressed by an angry parent. More than likely, for many of us, that parent would have been a father. Not least of all because so many classic expressions of the performance of masculinity reinforce the idea that anger is the one emotion that a, quote, real man is allowed to or even rewarded for expressing. On the other side of that stereotype, and I realize these are very broad strokes, we might find a cripplingly depressed mother or perhaps some other parent who struggled with their mental health. Maybe in the world in which we had some significant formative experiences, some emotions were just forbidden, either implicitly or explicitly. And if I was going to make a short list of some likely candidates for that idea, I might choose emotions like anger or sadness. And also, and some folks would find this a little bit of a head scratcher, but I would also say curiosity. There are so many reasons why, as parents, we might say to our kids, don't ask about that. You don't need to know that. That's a big person thing. Be dismissive of their curiosity. And I'm not saying, of course, that every child's every question should be answered in some full, exhaustive way at the moment when they ask it. Learning why a child is asking their question first can often point us to an age-appropriate and stage-appropriate answer. But having curiosity shut down categorically is something many of us have experienced. And it's stuck with us. So being curious about what it would be like to make the acquaintance of grief, for example, can get short-circuited right there. And then there are the religious reasons why we might not have ever gotten to know grief as a genuine companion in our journey. The odds are pretty decent that some of us that are listening to this podcast grew up in a religious community that made us feel guilty if we expressed any of the, you know, so-called negative emotions, that experiencing or expressing those was a sign of lack of faith because God should make us happy, right? Like God should rescue us from all those things. God is this redemptive figure in that narrative, this rescuer. And so if we did kind of raise those emotions or talk about our experiences of them, we had cause in those contexts to question our standing as a real believer, somebody who had a deep, substantial faith. Again, this is a perspective thing. I understand that. But to be blunt about it, from my perspective, I would say that that kind of thinking is basically a religious shortcut to one version of what I've called toxic happiness. It's a way to deny the full orb of the human experience. It might be called being faithful, but it doesn't even hold up in the light of that more traditional reading of Isaiah that I talked about, which would point to Jesus as, quote, a man of sorrows acquainted with grief, as the example any good Christian should follow of how to enact the character of God as a human being. It falls apart kind of right there in the text, if that's your perspective on the text. Beyond all of that, some of us have experienced the sorts of traumas that have upset the equilibrium of our emotional universe. And the world in general for us isn't a place where we find ourselves able to trust. And that runs pretty deep. For some of us, we're afraid that if we start crying, if we have an experience with grief that moves our emotions in that direction, we might never stop. So we tuck grief away in the attic of our lives, and we hope that she won't make too much of a fuss. But like the character in the novel, she tends to make her presence known, maybe as anger that we can't trace to a reasonable source. I certainly had some experiences of that myself this past week. My mom died very recently, less than a month ago, and I was outside watering some plants in our yard, and the hose got tangled up in a couple of watering cans. And what happened in me emotionally was that I just felt like I was so angry with those two watering cans. It sounds nonsensical when you tell the story, right? I would have happily kicked them into the river, like just sent them flying. And when I realized how out of proportion that emotion was to the context for it, that led me to ask the question, what's this about? Where's this coming from? And I realized, oh, this is grief. This is, for me, one of the faces of grief, anger that doesn't belong with its source. We might experience fear that keeps showing up as undealt with, a recurring fear about something that we can't seem to lay to rest by examining the source of the fear. For some of us, undealt with grief shows up in the ways in which we keep pushing away people we love, even though our rational mind knows better. It's a fearful thing to love what death can take, right? That idea. And so some of us, in not having considered that part of the human experience, find ourselves afraid to love others because they might leave. Maybe, and this is what brings this whole consideration around to the pursuit of happiness for me, maybe we are reluctant to become acquainted with grief because we're afraid that if we do, we might never be happy again. Maybe we're afraid that it's grief that knows the truth about reality, and that the truth about reality is that it's broken in ways that can't be fixed, and that if we got to know it, that would be it for our happiness. Maybe we're afraid that we would find out that the whole truth about reality is that it's a tale of loss, disappointment, betrayal, and then death, full stop. Life is, in fact, nasty, brutish, and short. And that's the whole deal. Maybe we're terrified that, to return to the metaphor we considered last week, grief might be the thing that tosses us out of the boat of our joy, and that we would drown in the sea of our sorrow. And yet, ancient and enduring wisdom, as well as contemporary insight into our experiences of things we might use words like balance or wellness for, suggests that sitting down and getting to know grief might reveal something quite different than what our fears suggest. That considered wisdom suggests that this might be the path to seeing reality in ways that can save us from being the prisoner of fear, that can relieve us of the constant vigilance of keeping sadness, our sadness, or sadness in life in general, a secret, that it might relieve us of the battle to keep the full version, the true version of our own stories locked away in a place that no one else is allowed to know about. Wouldn't that be something, to be relieved of those things? Those are some of the possibilities. They're not foregone. They don't come with guarantees, but they're possibilities, and I think that makes them intriguing. We're going to leave it there for now, and then next week we'll consider some of what sadness might have to say to us about happiness if we'll just make her acquaintance, if we'll just sit with her for a while and listen. Peace to you all. It's been good to be with you. Thanks for being with us this way. I look forward to being with you again soon. Bye-bye.